reminder, we are going to be mixing it up a little bit. Next week on Sunday, those of you who are listening the week of the 7th, I guess this is, we are going to be mixing up this life a little bit and doing it with Mike Catherwood, if you remember him from Loveline. And Bruce and I will also be doing a special weekly infusion with calls. All of these, and there will be also a Facebook Live and a YouTube channel live. And that's YouTube/Dr. Drew, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
So it's going to be a multimedia event next Sunday. We'll be doing both This Life with Catherwood and Bruce, you and I.
Oh.
So that will be all happening on the 16th of July. So do tune in to the YouTube channel, YouTube Dr. Drew, also Facebook Live. And as well, we'll be taking calls. Number to be announced probably on that Facebook. I don't have the number at this point. Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Foy
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around, and you're already on Facebook Live. This is another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and me, Bob Forrest.
And a reminder to check out the family podcast at drdrew.com, and please do support the people that support there and click through on the Amazon banner. And we have lots of good sponsors, and we really stand behind everybody that works with this podcast. We appreciate you guys' support.
If it weren't for the technology of Apple and the genius of Steve Jobs, we'd be out of business, right?
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, basically, it's all Steve Jobs things that we
use.
Well,
I was thinking, when you watch the Jobs movie, he's introducing the iPod.
Pod,
yeah, the, right.
the music one, right?
Yeah, and he's like 300 songs, and you're in this little device. Amazing! And I thought, wow, that was an amazing breakthrough. Look how far we've come since that.
You can have everything, 24 hours a day,
and here we are. But speaking of having everything, we have Randy Couture,
the king, right here.
Yeah, very exciting. Go ahead, you gush a little bit, Bob. You're very excited.
Well, I just want to pick his brain.
Hi, Randy.
Hey, Randy.
Hey, how are you guys?
Randy needs no intro. Of course, but he, you know, he's been on everything. Been on films, Scorpion, Expendable films. He's I didn't know he's a retired U.S. Army sergeant. I did not know that.
It's pretty obvious.
He's got that. It wasn't hard to believe. I just didn't know it.
So I thought Navy SEAL.
Yeah. So and Randy, you're also promoting right now your son's event. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my son Ryan he's my oldest of three children, and he's fighting this weekend, this Saturday, in Madison Square Garden. For Bellator Fighting Championship. It's Bellator 180. He's on the prelims, so you can find him streaming on Bellator.com. A great card. Going to be an amazing fight or set of fights on Saturday night here in New York City. So I'm very excited for him to get the opportunity to be on this card. This will be his 15th professional fight, and he's a very good fighter, and I'm very proud of him.
It's a big deal. This Bellator fight is created. I was in the city when they announced it, that big press conference.
Oh, really?
It was talked about in the streets. I mean, it was like, finally, it's back. It's fantastic. They were so excited. And were you at that press conference, Randy?
No, I didn't make that one.
It was a lot of I mean, the questions coming out of the audience, they've been waiting for years to ask these questions. It was so interesting. And
I got a lot of naive questions for you. Before MMA came on the scene, what was going on that you guys were doing? Because I figure you're the guy that knows the whole roots of this.
It really hit the United States market in 1993. And I think at that time, it was a bunch of different martial artists and combative sports athletes from different backgrounds out to show that their style of fighting and martial arts was the best. And I think quickly on, we realized, I think by UFC 6 or 7, we realized there was no one style that incorporated everything you needed to know. This hybrid sport kind of grew out of those early days. I came in as a wrestler around the time of UFC 13 and in 1997 to prove what wrestlers could do and what wrestlers, Olympic caliber and collegiate style wrestlers, were all about. And I quickly realized I needed to learn a whole bunch of other stuff. And now we kind of, you know, fast forward 20 plus years, and we have this hybrid sport where you have to be able to grapple, wrestle, striking in all its forms, and be able to do those proficiently in all those areas.
And strategically, too. Schooled is that it's like a chess match as much as it is, all those different skills. Would you agree, Randy?
Absolutely. I always liken it to kinetic chess. It's chess in a very physical sense.
But you realize, when you're going up against somebody, you realize what fighting technique they're not so good at doing, right? So don't you?
Well, I definitely try to study my opponents. You know, we talked about technology before we got started here. I mean, this day and age, I've got film. I've got my opponent's, you know, last nine fights on video. I can watch them, see how he's progressed, see where he seems to win fights, see where he seems to lose or not like to be, and kind of develop my idea of how he's progressed and where his tendencies are. Does he get tired? Is he a good striker, a good kicker? How are his submission skills? Is his takedown defense good? And kind of fashion a game plan based on what I see in that video footage.
And so what happened with Rousey? That's her name, right?
Ronda Rousey.
Ronda Rousey. So she came on the scene and just knocked everyone out in like 17 seconds and 33 seconds in a minute. And then all of a sudden, what happened? I think people got hip to what
she didn't. She didn't knock them out. She submitted them. She's a world-class judo player. She's a very physical athlete, especially for that weight class. She had the unique ability to be able to get her hands on just about all of her opponents and get them to the mat. And she was very, very good at submitting them.
So then what happened?
She got steered, in my opinion, and again, this is just my opinion, but I feel like she got steered in a poor direction by her coaching and her team. She started to develop confidence or maybe overconfidence in her ability to strike. And if you look at the fight before she fought Holly Holm, she fought a very good grappler. She ended up catching the girl with a nice punching combination and knocked the girl out where they're striking. Fast forward to the next fight, fighting a world-class
boxer
and kickboxer Holly Holm. And I think she had this false sense of her ability and security in her ability to strike. And she tried to strike with a world-class striker.
Wow.
And that didn't go so well. I think if she had a game plan where she trained to get her hands on Holly Holm and make Holly Holm grapple her and wrestle her, it would have been a different outcome.
And I think Holly had like massive reach too on her and everything, right? If I remember right, Randy?
Very, very long,
yeah.
Very good footwork, hard to get a handle on. Throws a really nice long jab, is a very good kicker, and ultimately it was the kick that finished the fight. And then in my opinion, the company didn't take very good care of Ronda, even though she was their biggest star at that time. They put her, as devastating as that loss was, they put her right back in there against another very, very good striker.
And this is important. This is important.
A recipe for disaster.
Yeah, this is important. Who you surround yourself with, and this goes back to original the sport of America, which was boxing. When you look at teams and a good group of people around, Mike Tyson being the most famous example of when Cus D'Amato was running the show with him, he was a champion, and everyone was frightened of him. When Cus died and he went into some other team, and then that's where it all starts to fall apart almost immediately, as soon as good people are not around the boxer or the fighter. And that, I imagine that happens in UFC for sure, right?
I think the people can be led astray. I think you need a coach and a team that's going to be honest, that's going to be real with you. Be able to tactfully tell you what your strengths and weaknesses are and force you to work on those things you need to work on. You don't want a bunch of sunshine folks that are just going to tell you exactly what you want to hear.
Do you think it's even that? Or
force you to get better.
Well, there's also, when you look at historically, it's all about branding now. I'm so sad for kids. Everything's a brand. The ball kids are a brand. Before they even graduate from high school, they're a brand. You know what I mean? And so when you look at Pacquiao or Mayweather, they become these brands. Where what about the boxing? You know what I mean? The boxing is almost like a secondary thing to the brand. What do you think about brands? Because UFC has been a huge brand, and they have the UFC gyms all over the world now. It became a brand.
The UFC is probably the largest promotion in the sport of mixed martial arts. It's certainly become very corporate.
They have gyms, right?
Forcing their athletes to wear uniforms and all of those things, I think, have changed the sport a bit. Where, you know, when I started competing, there was 7, 8, or 9 shows in a year, maybe one a month if you're lucky. Now there's literally a show from one promotion or another every single weekend. And I think you touched on something with boxing. I think the difference is it's not so much that these guys are a brand, But they become more concerned about winning or losing and doing what they need to do to secure a victory instead of going out there and putting it on the line. And I think that's why a lot of fans with boxing anyway are a little dismayed. They don't like some of the decisions. They don't like the way a lot of these guys fight. We're seeing a little influx now with guys like Canelo and some of these other guys, Triple G and Kovalev, that Andre Ward, that really get after it, likening themselves to those old school days, Thomas Hearns, Hagler, you know, Ali, Frazier, Foreman. Those guys, when somebody was set up to fight in those days, you knew somebody was getting knocked on their butt and they were going to get after it. There was none of this doing what you needed to do, win 12 rounds.
Yeah,
it was exciting, and you knew, you were never sure who or what was going to happen. And that I think, is what the fans want to see. I think that's why they've taken to MMA as much as they have. There's so many ways to win or lose a fight. It's a very volatile sport, mixed martial arts, and those style matchups can really make a big difference. And mixed martial artists, at least in my opinion, in this day and age, are still putting it on the line. They're getting after it. They're taking risks, and they're trying to win fights for the most part.
I've been in radio so long, I've interviewed some of these guys over the years, and I was there at the beginning of all this, right?
Yeah.
And interviewed Tank Abbott.
Who's Tank Abbott?
Well, back in the very early days, it was just a bunch of guys who were huge, like big, like Fletcher from Pennywise. He would have been a good MMA fighter back then, who wanted to be violent. And I interviewed Tank, and I go, no, dude, you're just, he goes, he looks at me and he goes, no, man, I'm a bad dude. I'm bad. I'm not a good guy. I'm awful. And then he smiled at me with all his teeth missing. And I thought, whoa, this is going to be an interesting sport. And then it went, then it sort of evolved quickly, very quickly moved out of that to into something more skilled. And then a lot of steroids came in, a lot of like, and guys were sort of roiding out and stimulating out and opiating out and stuff. Yeah. We saw some guys killing themselves and things. Remember that whole phase, Randy?
Well, I know we started testing in 2000. The sport really started in 93 in the U.S. And, you know, there are still some promotions abroad that aren't governed by
Japan.
Sanctioning bodies and athletic commissions.
Japan encourages it, right? They encourage that whole, well, I forget what that sport's called, but they encourage as much chemical alteration. Yes, right?
They certainly don't
discourage
it. They're not dissuading anybody from it.
So what's it like afterwards? So these kids come up for 8 or 10 years, right? Guys, 24, 26, 28, 20. Now you got this transition. How do you shut it off? Because one of the things I thought was different than boxing was going to happen in this sport was everybody's going to be a badass if you're walking down the street with your wife, and because it's so, you understand what I'm saying? It's so street. It's so
not anymore.
Well,
it's not. I don't look at it as street. Fighting on the street is a different thing completely.
But do people challenge? But do people
technical sport? I think if you look at the athletes that we have in our sport, the majority of them are college educated guys that came from a specific combative sports or martial arts background.
Yeah.
And this is their chance to be a professional athlete.
I know. I'm just saying, I'm not saying that the fighters are that way. I'm talking about the public. When you're in a club in Las Vegas and you're drunk, somebody's drunk and they start slinging at you. You know what I mean?
At him or just at one?
At one of the fighters.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What is that response? Is there? Does that stuff happen? I figured it did, and I always wondered.
No, they wouldn't know.
I've heard very few stories about things like that.
They can't
most
afford
of the guys
it.
That I know that train.
I'm not saying they
level,
would fight them, but
on their shoulder.
I'm saying the public. Yeah, the public with a chip on his shoulder thinks he's a badass. The tank of nowadays
is
drunk in a bar, and MMA fighters.
Arnold
there.
Schwarzenegger gets that crap. I mean, anybody that is big gets that crap. It's a way Arnold had to have bodyguards because that was his biggest problem. People coming up trying to fight him drunk. Back when he was, you know, bodybuilder and stuff, that was his thing. Yeah, so I'm sure
drunk people do a lot of stupid.
Yeah, right. For sure. I had a note here. I'm interested in about your current health, your current what do we call it? Protocol. Oh, we have to take a break. All right, I'm going to talk about your current health protocol when we get back. Be right back after this. A couple months ago, I introduced you to RefaWise. It's a prescription-saving card you can get right now on your phone for free, and I was thrilled to hear many of you did so. You signed up, and that some of you have saved as much as $150 at every pharmacy visit. We heard these stories, and we appreciate them. Now, if you already have your RefaWise card on your phone, remember, you can't save unless you use it. You got to use the card on your phone. Just open the message, show it to your pharmacist next time you get a prescription filled. It is as easy as that. Just say, what can you do with this? Because they'll decide for you what's the least expensive alternative. If you haven't done it yet, grab your phone and text Drew to the number 22822. Immediately, your RefaWise card will be sent to your screen. It's really fast. Just that's the word Drew, D-R-W, to a number 22822. And if you have an insurance, you might actually save more with the RefaWise card. And if you don't need the card today, chances are you know someone who's struggling with the high cost of medication, aren't we all now? Help them out by telling them about the RefaWise card. We appreciate that. Also excited to say that for every RefaWise user, every new user, they will donate $1 to the Prostate Cancer Foundation. That is a charity that's near and dear to my heart. And I want you to learn more about RefillWise. You can see if your medication could be covered. Just visit refillwise.com. But go ahead, let's do it now. Start saving right now. Text Drew, that is Drew, to the number 22822. Message and data rates may apply. RefillWise. Okay, we're back.
We're back.
Randy, you're an advocate for testosterone replacement, and I kind of am too, believe it or not. And do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, obviously there was a loophole for a little while in the sport of mixed martial arts. It's not something I ever did. I did have my hormone levels checked on a regular basis. We put our bodies under a lot of stress through the training process, and certainly as an older athlete, your body's ability to produce testosterone becomes an issue.
Yeah.
Legitimate. Certainly when you're trying to perform at a high level, maintain a lean body and conditioning and all those things. I chose not to do TRT. I chose to use natural means to boost my body's own production of testosterone, but it's something you have to be very
We're both very interested in
that. How do you do that, Randy? Help us.
We're both very interested.
How do you do that naturally? Because I need that.
We're both very interested.
There are herbs and precursors to testosterone without injecting testosterone into your body that force your own gonads to produce more testosterone.
So it's what's the mushroom? It starts with a B.
Tribulus.
I started tribulus. I took tribulus for about
tribulus. There's a lot of different things.
I took tribulus for 3 months. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer on the heels of that. So I've always been worried about that one being an issue.
Disclaimer.
Be that as it may.
I've been taking tribulus for probably over 10 years, and I haven't had any issues.
Okay, there you go. So there's the balance, the yin and the yang of
We don't know is the bottom line, but it does work. I know that for a fact. Do you take DHEA or something like that also, or what are you doing?
DHEA is also one of those precursors to testosterone that kind of jumpstarts your body's own production.
How much do you take? What's the recommended dose of that? That's sort of a folklore. What do you say?
I think between 3 and 10 milligrams. It's pretty small.
That's very small. Because it comes in 25, 50s, and hundreds.
No, I've never seen them that big.
Yeah.
I think I'm looking at a
maybe it's different.
10 milligrams.
Maybe you're on DHEAS?
Is that I'm not sure the difference.
Yeah. It's just a different stage in the congeners. That's all different. The sulfate.
And this is just to all feel alive and vitalized.
Well, you know, we're all living so long. I think it's a legitimate thing to try to, you know, if our thyroid goes out, we take thyroid replacement. If women, their ovaries go out, they take hormone. I mean, it has risks and benefits, but it's a legitimate treatment for the way we live our lives now.
And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, people have been aware of menopause for years and years and the downside to that and using hormone replacement therapy and a lot of those things for women, but it's not something you ever really thought about for men. And then it's just been in recent years, some of these anti-aging clinics and some of the other things, that we've kind of gotten used to this idea that there's a menopause as well as a menopause. And guys have some of those same similar issues with their hormones.
Yeah, men's health is not that big a priority in the World Health Order. I was a part of that Movember thing, right? Just to get people to get the prostate checked. You know, Randy, there's a new thing that is starting to come up in American culture called despair death. The men, white men particularly, in their 50s, dying of despair death, which is accidental drug overdose, alcoholism-related diseases, suicide. Yeah. And I just always think men need to talk more openly and honestly, and they just don't. We're kind of too
proud. We're marginalized, too. We're marginalized. We don't like feeling powerless, and the powerlessness, the marginalization.
I just love that he's talking about testosterone. I think that's amazing.
Our society fashions us to believe that weakness and vulnerability are bad things, that we're not supposed to show those things. And I mean, it's the first thing you look in and when you look at somebody else, and the last thing you want anybody to see when you have them look at you. And I think that's something that's it's ingrained in our society. The same with the crazy standards that we've applied to women and what's beauty and what's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it's the other side of that same coin.
Yeah. You know, how do we teach our kids different values when society has these? I've been trying to teach my kids different values.
I would also
encourage, they come up in culture to these right. stereotypical values.
And I would urge us all not to sort of think about society as something other than us. We are society.
But when you tell your kid...
I don't know what else society needs. Yeah. We are
that. Are it, yeah. Go ahead,
when you tell your kid you don't need to worry about this thing, you're just a kid going to school, and that's your job in the family, and they're being frightened by media and frightened by their peers.
Yeah.
That type
when I
of
talk
stuff.
About when I think of society, I'm thinking of, look at the TV commercials, look at the magazine ads,
yes.
look at all these things that we're inundated with from the time we're a little kid watching television. It skews our perspective in a particular way.
It does, and you can't avoid a lot of it, but ultimately the primary unit of insulation and of transmission of cultural information is the family. So you keep on them. You know, you stay unified, you stay on them, you stay with them, you stay stable, you stay connected, and that will help. It may not keep it all out, of course, but it really is the buffer. It's the.
Is it proper to say to other friends? Here's the thing. So with me and Elvis, I have a 6-year-old, Randy, and he's just video game conscious, right? I don't like video games. I try to keep him away from it. But there are some that I find, you know, are productive. Minecraft. He has to create things. He has to kind of think. But there's these ads that come up in the Xbox for these horrible, you know, kind of videos.
Horrible. It's going to be his favorite thing in about 4
years. Yes, what I'm saying is as soon as they see that, they want that. They want Call of Duty. He wants to know what's Call of Duty. You know what I mean? And that's for grown-up kids.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. I have a 14-year-old who loves video gaming and the whole video gaming culture. And it's not, you know... I grew up when Pong came out, and that was as exciting as it got. And now there's stuff, the graphics and all the things in these games are so amazing, but at the same time, they're so consuming. Mm-hmm.
They really are consuming.
Sit there for hours on end and play those games if you let them. And I don't know how engaging and healthy that is.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I found is a great tool. There's a box in our house behind the TV that's the Wi-Fi box. I just go and pull the electrical plug out.
Trust me, he will figure that out. He'll wire your house with some special stuff. He'll be climbing up the telephone pole and tapping in.
Back.
Yeah, tapping into something.
It's crazy how addictive that stuff is.
Yeah,
and
it's pretty intense.
So. Well, what do you think? You really think? Gosh, I'm gonna try to go to this Mayweather McGregor fight. I think
it's gonna be one of those crazy fights. I think there's gonna be a ton of hype. Obviously, both those guys are very adept at hyping a fight, at running their mouths to the point where you kind of want to see one of them get knocked on their ass. Frankly,
yeah. And it's gonna
honestly tactically, if I evaluate the fight as much as I like Conor McGregor and the way he competes. He's stepping into a boxing ring for a boxing match with one of the best boxers, a guy that's undefeated in his career, and he's never had a professional boxing match. This is not MMA. It's not the same thing. They're apples and oranges.
Wow.
Now, he's got a couple things going for him. He's long and rangy for that weight class, and he's unorthodox. He's not going to throw punches like every other boxer that Floyd Mayweather has faced. I think that gives him a slight chance in catching Floyd with something.
Well,
Floyd is one of the most elusive and defensive fighters that we've seen in this generation of boxers. So,
but going back to your point about Mayweather and the dancing that's been going on for 15 years in boxing, Mayweather can't really have a concrete plan for McGregor because he doesn't know what's going to happen, does he? Or can he?
No, I think it makes it more difficult. Floyd's the one that's got the pressure and everything to lose in this fight. McGregor, I don't think, is under a lot of expectation and really has no pressure. He's the chance to go out and make more money in this boxing match than he would have made in his entire career as a mixed martial artist. And that's a whole nother story that we can talk about. But, you know, I think it's going to be interesting. There's going to be a ton of hype. I hope it's not boring. That's my
general concern. That's my fear, is that it's going to be boring in a
dance. It's going to be like Pacquiao Mayweather. That was, so much hype and fanfare, and then it turned out to really kind of be a dud.
Susan, anything on Facebook Live for us? Any questions?
One of the things
I
wanted to...
Hold on, she's smiling. Is there?
No,
she's just reading people's comments.
I think you need to tell them that you're taking questions. I haven't really...
Okay, I will just...
We'll take some questions on Facebook Live, but I've got one for Randy.
Okay, real quick. I also want to remind them about Heal.com. Again, go get the app. Go to Heal.com. You get a physician in your house within 2 hours, board certified. We've hand-selected these people. $99 all in, or insurance plus copay. That's it. And you get in within 2 hours. You don't pay for all the infrastructure and personnel and the emergency room. You don't need any of that. You need somebody in your house, especially if you have kids or elderly parents. Check it out, heal.com.
So I got this question. My thought is Mayweather hasn't knocked somebody out in a while, right? So he's older. Can McGregor take any punch somebody that Mayweather can hit him in the head with? Can't he keep on his feet, don't you think, Randy?
Well, I don't think McGregor's going to get knocked out.
Oh, okay.
I just don't think he's going to win.
Okay.
Mayweather's not a knockout guy. He's not going to go out and put it on the line and take that risk and get in McGregor's face and try to knock him out. He's going to hit him. He's going to stick and move and be elusive and score and win the rounds, which is, again, my fear.
That's
going to
be boring. That's going to be boring.
But Mayweather's on the record saying he didn't care. He just wants the money. He didn't care.
Yeah,
he wants to win.
I mean,
he wants
always
money.
About the money with Floyd.
Yeah,
that's kind of his persona. So
yeah. I wanted to tell you this other thing. So I go to a lot of boxing matches in Las Vegas. I used to work out there in the courts, and I have a connection. So I went to the Bradley Pacquiao fight where Pacquiao beat his ass for 10 out of 12 rounds, and they called it for Bradley. It was the craziest thing I ever saw in my life.
I watched that fight. I agree with
that
you.
That was crazy. I was in the arena.
Wow.
Like, people, that is Vegas, that. Baby.
Yeah. So, Randy, where do you live now?
I live in Las Vegas.
Oh, there you go.
And
I've been there 12 years. I grew up in Seattle. I lived in Oregon for a very long time, and then about 12 years ago, I moved from Oregon to Las Vegas, and I've been in Vegas ever since.
Tell us something that people aren't likely to know about you.
I have a degree in foreign language and literature. I majored in German, and I've been writing prose and poems since I was in college in the 80s.
And the literature was German literature, or was it literature and then
German?
I
was in foreign language and literature, but I specialized in German. So I did have a focus on more of the German authors, Goethe and Schilling and Kafka and those guys. But I did – it was an arts and science degree with a lot of focus on all of the literature, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, all of them.
Where'd you go to school?
Oklahoma State.
Very interesting. So –
Well,
what's your
Renaissance
favorite?
Man,
what's
they don't make men like this anymore.
I'm just thinking.
Your Uncle Norm says to give that he's sending hugs. By
Uncle
the way.
Norm sending hugs.
Norm, that's Ryan's uncle, my son's uncle, and he lives in Seattle where I grew up.
Fantastic. And did you get to philosopher Schleiermacher and Nietzsche and all these guys in German too, or was that
absolutely?
Wow,
absolutely.
I always thought reading Kant in German would be the most unpleasant experience because it's hard enough in English.
It is a crazy difficult language. I lived there when I was in Germany in the army for 3 years, which created the interest. After my 6 years in the army, I got a college scholarship to wrestle at Oklahoma State. And when I showed up there as a freshman at 25 years old, I wasn't sure what I wanted to study. So I started taking foreign language classes because I suffered from that language barrier when I lived there for 3 years.
What's your favorite Dostoevsky novel?
Oh, man. Well, my favorite novel is Cervantes.
Oh, Don Quixote. Have you read Don Quixote?
Yeah.
It's like reading a cartoon. I was so surprised how slapstick it was. I was really surprised.
Funny.
It was funny.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
it
why
was
Monty Python loved it so much.
Yes. I was shocked. And then I didn't, you know, it's in two books, right? And they brought it back. It's like it was so popular they had to go on and do it again. And wow, I was shocked when I read that book.
I am a sick man. I am a bad man. I am an ill man. Dostoevsky. That's a great way to open a novel, huh?
Oh, yeah.
So you obviously are around millennials. We talk a lot about millennials on this show, Randy, and there's, you know, not to generalize, but there seems to be, they are a generation like no other is what I say. And there's a lot of good self-esteem for apparently no reason, in a large swath of them. I wondered if you deal with millennials. They must be fans of yours. What have you noticed about millennials that's so different than baby boomers or Gen X or?
Well, I think we don't get a lot of that type of attitude in the sport of mixed martial arts. I run a training center and a school for mixed martial artists because individual combative sports, in my opinion, build more character than just about any athletic endeavor out there because of the individuality of it and the sheer vulnerability of it. And I think I don't know a single one that hasn't had their ass kicked at one time or another.
That's what I keep saying needs to happen to these kids.
This whole giving a medal to everybody that competes has kind of created this sense of, which, like you say, false bravado. I think we as humans, there are a few things we have to have. Obviously, we need to eat, breathe, sleep, and I think love.
Yeah.
And to that, I would add struggle. I think we need struggles. We need to have those challenges to overcome.
Randy, I found myself lately championing ordinary misery. That learning to
tolerate, deal,
manage ordinary misery, and perhaps, as you're even saying, give yourself, add some misery and try to overcome it. Add some challenges and see what you can do.
Well, I still think there's any way to escape it. It's part of life. Yeah. No one escapes pain, fear, some form of misery. And if we try to shelter these kids from what life really is all about, then we're not really preparing them to go out and deal with it.
That's right.
We didn't. And so the question is, when do you introduce it? And
see, I always thought you could do it through sports and academics, because that's kind of miserable. they can be miserable for kids that are struggling. Just poor persevere.
No, but the parents become the advocates for how unjust the school system is.
No.
That's what happens.
That's a split. That's splitting. That's splitting behavior.
I absolutely believe that athletics is. That's why athletics are so important for our kids. They teach us about winning and losing. They teach us about overcoming, about getting out of something exactly what you put into it.
Becoming
I think
good
you can
at
say
something.
The same thing about academics. If that's where your passion is, maybe you're not as athletically inclined, but there's something else, whether it be playing the cello or something else academic oriented, then that's where your passion is. That still takes work. You're still going to fail from time to time. It's still going to be a struggle.
And it's interesting, you know, people that work out regularly, that have athletic, you know, prowess, military, you know, challenges, also seem magically be able to do well academically and in business, blah, 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 blah. You know, it translates in every sphere of life. You know, you can use those skills everywhere.
And it's a crazy thing. So you're out there. Are you in Summerlin or are you in real Vegas?
I'm in Southern Highlands.
Highlands. There you go. I lived in the one Las Vegas there on South Las Vegas Boulevard, that double tall building.
Okay. Yeah.
On Blue Diamond Highway and Las Vegas Boulevard. I lived there for years. I love Vegas. And I kept telling Drew, there's a Las Vegas you have no idea. It's the most beautiful parks, the best schools, it's the best everything.
Yeah.
Because of all the tax revenue that comes from the gambling, it's the greatest community in the world if you don't go to the Strip.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Everybody equates it with the Strip and the craziness or the crazy weekend on the Strip. And there's a whole other world to Vegas. I love when family or friends come to visit, and we don't take them down there. We go out to
Red Rock,
Good Springs, to the Pioneer Saloon, or you know, somewhere out in the desert to go shoot. Or you know, I mean, there's just so many other things to do.
Red Rock is so beautiful. They just found some 90 million year old bones up in this canyon west of Vegas.
Well, Randy, thank you for joining us. We have to kind of wrap things up. Any Facebook questions?
Well, we're gonna take some. So why don't you tell everybody that to hang on? And
all right,
we're gonna take some questions.
All right, and then we'll let Randy go. Randy,
such an honor to meet you, Randy.
Yeah. Is there a website or any place else you'd like people to go?
You can find me at extremecouturemma.com or extremecoutureclothing.com. And I'm on Facebook as Randy the Natural Couture, XC Natch on Instagram, and Randy _ Couture on Twitter.
There you go, Randy. Thank you so much. We will be back with your Facebook questions and the great Randy Couture, everybody. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you, man.
You bet. Thank you.
So when you're sick, the last thing you want to do is get dressed and drive to a doctor's office or an urgent care. Listen, you can get a licensed, highly trained, board-certified physician right in your home or office, on demand, on your schedule, without exposing yourself to anybody else sick or waiting. That is exactly what you get with Heal. Heal is a mobile app that puts the power of on-demand medical care at your fingertips. Simply sign up at Heal.com, download the app, and you will get a top-notch, board-certified physician when and where you need it. Within 2 hours, Heal doctors are on call 7 days a week, 365 days a year, in a growing number of locations, including Los Angeles, Orange County, San Diego, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Northern Virginia. And Heal accepts most major insurance plans, so you'll be responsible for just your copay with most insurances, and it is otherwise $99 all in without insurance. I serve on the Heal Advisory Board because I believe this is the future of medicine. I cannot say enough about the quality of care available through Heal, and I urge you to check it out today. For more information, visit heal.com/Drew. That is heal.com/Drew.
Okay, Drew, get off your phone. We're going to talk about Carrie Fisher.
All right, let's do it. So we had speculated.
I said get off your phone.
So we had speculated. Sorry, I thought I was.
We speculated and we were shockingly wrong, though we were right.
Yeah, we were wrong because there wasn't fentanyl or Xanax, which we would normally anticipate.
But when I got forwarded the autopsy and I saw heroin on there, yeah. I was like, oh my God. Two things happened. The Carrie I loved, I had junky respect for. Yeah. I don't know why. It's so sick. But I was just like, that takes guts and a set of you know what don't know that I have.
So in other words, to go all the way to heroin.
All the way back.
Yeah. Now what do you speculate happened?
I speculate she got upset over 3 years ago over this lawsuit she was in.
Yeah.
She went to a doctor.
Yeah. Headache, back
sleeping,
pain,
sleeping.
Yeah.
Couldn't sleep, worried about this lawsuit. Yeah. Then came a second go round, which was the horrible, hideous stuff on the internet about her appearance in Star Wars about a year ago.
Oh, really?
You didn't know about this?
No.
She was crying.
Because people called her like
old and fat. And my whole thing, I learned this in 2007 in Celebrity Rehab. Don't read the internet. If you're on television, don't read it.
No, that's right.
Because they're such gross, mean-spirited. Mm-hmm. And she did a big thing in Vanity Fair to try to counter how emotionally she was affected by this horrible, horrible shit.
So that may have been where she got headaches and back pain and then went to a doctor for that. And then off we go.
Yep.
And then eventually it goes to heroin.
Once in the clutches of Beverly Hills doctors.
So we expected that she would have died of prescription medication.
Yes.
So we still speculate that it got going with prescription
medication.
Almost undoubtedly, right?
Yeah. And dealing with not just what we call life's everyday misery, but real,
horrible stuff.
Horrible stuff. Yeah. Right?
And
getting sued's a horrible, stressful situation. Yeah. Being attacked for no reason for being 60 years old.
Yeah.
It's just people are so ill.
Yeah.
They're just so ill.
Yes.
And I know she was profoundly affected by the negative response from Star Wars.
Oh. And she's such a delightful person.
She's the greatest.
It's painful to hear this.
Funniest, self-effacing. But this is another thing. Tough broads like her, I would say tough broad underneath soft.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And her dying of addiction doesn't change or diminish any of that.
Doesn't take any of it away.
There's a couple things, weeds things we need to get into. She was over in the United Kingdom doing the Catastrophe Show. You need to see it. She's great in it. It's a great movie, series on Amazon. It's a great series. And she plays an alcoholic mom, mom of an alcoholic. And it's the story of a struggle. And I'm suspicious that maybe she got going over there, ran out of pills or whatever, and that's probably the ecstasy kicked in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Because it's a different culture over there. We're like, oh, honey.
The ecstasy makes no sense at all.
In England, it makes sense.
It does?
Oh, there's shitloads of it.
Really?
Excuse me. Sorry, Facebook. They do a lot of it, and especially, you know, London and that area. So it I think that made whoever was probably getting her the heroin was probably also, honey, a little bit of this.
Yeah,
of that.
That's where, you know, a lot of my sober friends have been like, where would she ever know where to get heroin? I say, well, there's two sides of the world. There's the non-heroin side of the world, and then there's the heroin side of the world. And
let me tell you about
the people you buy Xanax from know where to get heroin.
Let me tell you with a heroin London story. Did you ever know Alex? Alex gone before you got there? We had a counselor named Alex. She was a Eastern European.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Remember Alex?
Before I worked there, but I knew her. Okay. I knew her.
She, when she was trying to get sober from heroin, detoxed and then went to go find her roots. That was the problem. She had to go back to Eastern Europe and find her roots. Then she wouldn't use heroin anymore. She decided. So she had a layover in London. And she was going to be in London for like 6 hours. She went from Heathrow to go to the National Gallery. And she said she hadn't been in London 2 hours before she was slamming heroin with the security guard of the main gallery in the National Gallery of London. And I thought, oh, that's the best heroin story ever. How do you know to walk up to a guy with a baton and a hat and a uniform and go, hey, man, he's ready to slam? Let's go. Come to the bathroom with me.
What's happening?
Yeah. And heroin addicts see it. They know other heroin addicts. They just know it.
See it now at Walgreens.
Oh, boy. See, I don't... Oh, Jesus. Somebody asked a question. Okay, you're not... Go ahead.
Somebody asked a question. Could the ecstasy have been cut with the other stuff?
No. The question... But the heroin could have had stuff in it, like the methadone, the Demerol, these other things.
The methadone was a derivative. It's a breakdown of a prescription medication.
Maybe. But the point is... And the coroner's report was one of the best toxicology reports I've ever seen. It was, you know, in terms of, it wasn't forensic, but it was a nice, thorough discussion.
How many drugs are really in her system? Seven?
It's hard to know.
Three cocaine, antidepressants.
Cocaine, alcohol.
Three antidepressants.
She had Abilify, Fluoxetine, Lamictal, which was appropriate. She's bipolar. Yeah. She had cocaine, alcohol, which is, she had MDMA, and then she had several different opiates, and it's hard to know which is a congener, which was a contaminant, what was what. You know, again, Europe, we know what people are getting over here. They don't know
what
we're getting.
So what we want to say to the sober community is, listen, if you're old, you're going to have back pain. If you're under attack or duress or there's life things coming up, reach out to your friends.
Sober friends.
Don't go to a doctor.
They're not going to
treat you right.
The physicians like me don't understand addiction. They're really not trained in it. I only happen to know it because I was just in it for years and years working with it. Most doctors don't have that. I didn't understand it when I got into it. I didn't understand it at all. It took me 5 years to really get decent at it. Decent, not good. It took me another 5 years.
So if somebody
kind of
came to you in your first couple years of being a licensed doctor and said, I can't sleep, you would just say, oh.
Yeah, Ambien, boom. And you seem a little anxious to me. Here's some Xanax. And I said, oh, by the way, some Zoloft probably. You know, you're just trained that way. And you don't really know how to assess and suss out what you're exactly doing. As an internist, as a psychiatrist, they kind of are. But as a general practitioner, you're really not. You're not really skilled at sussing it out. And even those that have an interest and are skilled at it really don't. Like the cardiologist that gave Ativan to Chris Cornell, I'm sure in his mind he was like, No. He never abused it. I gave him the same supply every month, 2 milligrams a night of Ativan. No big deal. I mean, he kept, for years he was on the stable dose doing fine, not understanding that the disease of addiction the entire time is activated, and the thinking and the obfuscation and the BSing all gets going, and they slide into their disease even though they're not escalating the drug you're prescribing. That's what doctors just can't get through their head. The average doctor, you know.
You just get another doctor, and then you get double.
Well, now it's on the addict at a certain point. Addicts do have a responsibility in this as well. But I want to say something else that the press is reporting that Carrie Fisher died of a sleep apnea related thing.
Yeah, I don't get that.
Well, let me explain it to you. The medical examiners and the coroners are held to specific legal standards where they have to be able to have a chain of causation to the cause of death. And they couldn't make that. For instance, she had cocaine in her system, but she didn't have coke ethylene, which is alcohol and cocaine together. Coke ethylene is cardiotoxic and causes arrhythmias. If she'd had some coke ethylene in, they would have gone, ooh, probably this is an arrhythmia. But maybe she did, and maybe it wasn't the opiates. You can't prove it was the opiates. You and I know it's the opiates. We know clinically, she took a bunch of opiates, she stopped breathing. The sleep apnea was sort of like kindling, and the opiates were like the Caseline, and it made it easier to stop her breathing because of the sleep apnea. But the opiates made her stop breathing. That's it, period.
Why can't it say you know, like I think her daughter said in one of the statements.
That daughter was spot
she,
on.
Yeah, she was great. She was like, my mom died of addiction.
Period.
And mental because health, and you shouldn't be ashamed of that.
Clinicians can say that. The medical examiners can't because it's a legal document they're creating. It's a legal standard. It's a whole set of standards that are different than what you and I think of as an assessment of a clinical situation. Now, sometimes they screw it up because of that. Like for instance, one of the things about Carrie's death, if you look at the report, she died of natural causes.
I know. Well, they say that about everybody.
Right. Because an opiate overdose is considered a natural cause.
No.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
It's not an unnatural event in the environment?
I know.
My friend Chris Whitley was this blues guitar player, singer, and I saw his obituary in the paper, and it said natural causes.
Yeah.
I was like, he's 44 years old or something. How can it be natural
causes? That's a legal...
Just naturally
that's
you
a
die.
Medical examiner's legal standard. Nicole and Jemmy explained that to me on Weekly Infusion. I didn't understand that because I was going off about George Michaels. I'm like, no, he had cardiomyopathy.
Oh, yeah, he was natural causes, too.
Yeah, he had advanced liver disease from my uncle. He had advanced liver disease. He had a cardiomyopathy, and he had substance. It's like, Jesus, it's all related to substances, natural causes, because there was no medical issue at the time of death.
So what they need is cancer.
Yes. Heart disease.
Stroke.
Yes.
They need that.
They need a medical diagnosis that leads to demise. To be not natural cause, essentially. I mean, that's how I understand it. But the point is, they have all kinds of different weird legal standards that I don't understand that are bizarre and not clinically relevant. So, she died of an opiate addiction. You have something
she
else?
She will be missed.
Oh, my God. Sarah, it's a tragic story. What's up?
I have a couple of marijuana questions. Dr. Dew, would you recommend marijuana as a remedy for anxiety and high stress for a person without health insurance coverage? Okay, that's one. And then the other one is, what are your thoughts on marijuana use with bipolar PTSD anxiety?
Bad idea.
Instead on meds prescribed.
That guy can say it's a bad idea. There's not evidence that that would work.
For anxiety, anytime it's a bad idea.
CBD itself may have some utility with other things, but as a primary treatment, no. The first guy, though, asked an interesting question, which was, I don't have access to health care. I have access to cannabis. I have panic attacks, and I'm not an addict. I'm going to superimpose that
benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, benefit of the doubt. Would occasionally use some marijuana be okay? And I'm like,
I'm not against anything.
I'm not against anything either.
I just don't like.
I'm not recommending it because the data's not there to support it. But
Don't mix
I just
it
don't
with
like
ecstasy,
that everybody's
cocaine,
anxious.
Alcohol, and
heroin.
Everybody's misdiagnosing themselves as anxious.
Yeah.
It's a real thing, and it's an insult to truly people who suffer from anxiety.
Hey, I have
for everybody anxiety. To say they're anxious.
Yeah.
Do 12-year-old kids say they're anxious?
They
I go,
are.
What does that mean?
They should be.
What does that mean?
You're supposed to
No,
be.
It's a word they learned from their parents and doctors.
Yeah. I mean, we're just
a kid's natural thing is I'm feeling anxious right now.
You know what we called it when we were kids was, hey, reality sucks. Reality sucks, man.
Yeah.
Right? The world sucks.
I hate school.
Yeah.
That's not.
I don't know which is worse, though. In a way, realizing that no, my feelings suck, and anxiety is one of those feelings. That's kind of a progress. I don't know. You're right. There's too much focus on not feeling good. That because not feeling good is the normal state of humanity. I mean, it is. But feeling horrible is not. And sort of where is that differentiation between I don't feel good all the time or I have some bad feelings versus I feel horrible.
I can give you an example this morning. So I'm dealing with this guy. He's anxious. He's getting discharged on Friday. He was told he has and blah, 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 and da, da, da. And you know how it is in a rehab. So then he comes at me as soon as I walk in the door and blah, 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 blah. And he's trying to once more days or, you know, once, you know, 2 months or something.
Post-ski
withdrawal. So then literally 15 minutes later, he's laughing and everything's great.
Well, that's how
and
you know. Listen,
that's
Bob,
life.
No, Bob, but that's also how you know it's post-ski withdrawal because when they're in it, they feel like it's never going to end. And particularly if some benzos involved with benzo withdrawal.
Meth.
Because they feel when they're in it.
Maybe benzos. You got to come down somehow.
Yeah, I think there's some benzos there. They just feel like it's never going to end. It's always going to be around. It's never going to, you know, that's that kind of weird thinking they get into when
but
they're in a bad state.
But what I'm saying is people keep insisting that they're trapped in a feeling state. And feelings are transient and they come and they go.
Yep. Even suicidality. That's why you put people in a place for a while. And then it goes.
And it ebbs and flows. Yeah. What's strange is we have things in our culture that say, don't be too happy. You're naive. The other shoe's going to drop. Yeah. All this kind of stuff. Like, rather than embrace or understand that feeling states, sadness, loss, grief, happiness, joy.
Some of that is that people are trauma survivors. And
they get stuck in it.
They get stuck. And then that's what the problem is.
But then you verbally reinforce your
stuckness. Yes, I agree. Okay. It still waxes and wanes to some degree. It's just the degree of the numbers of people in the last 30 years that have that proclivity makes it seem matter of fact. Susan, something else?
I don't know what naltrexone is, but this guy, Steve, wants to know if it's good for alcoholism.
It kind of is.
What is it?
We were with a woman last night that was advocating Vivitrol. Remember that?
Yes.
Well, that's Vivitrol, one version of it.
Generic
version. But what is it?
It's an opioid blocking, and it
I love it. The people, they have implants of it. They have monthly shots of it. They have oral daily.
I will get you a shot, honey.
I just don't know what it is.
It helps a little bit.
Yeah, it helps a little bit.
Okay, here's one from Alexander Mail. What's the longest treatment for PTSD with sertraline last? With sertraline last?
I don't know what that question is.
I don't know if he wrote that right.
Sertraline is an antidepressant.
It's helped with getting my anxiety attacks, but the VA isn't giving me a definite answer
on how long
I'll be on it.
Years.
I've been on it for a month.
No, years for sure. And that's if you're doing active therapy, and you should be doing active therapy. And group, a big part of that, particularly if you have sort of military kinds of exposure with your PTSD. I want to go back to Vivitrol, because not enough is made of that stuff. Naltrexone, we should all have naltrexone in our hand in case we come across somebody with an opiate overdose.
Yeah.
Because you can reverse it immediately, they'll wake up.
Oh, that's
and they'll
the
survive.
Thing. It's like Narcan.
It's Narcan. Narcan is a form of naltrexone.
There's
a relative
two
of
other things. I believe it has some reducing of kind of thinking about opiates with opiate addicts. But it also, they all love taking pills, and when they take the pill and they're just, oh, I can't use, and all, they reinforce it. Whereas when you told me or Steve Earle or other junkies in the 80s, oh, you're going to be on this blocker, we just like, oh, no, well, no, I can get through it. Well, they're followed directions people
I will
now.
Maybe that's good for the millennials. I've said that the research shows that the Vivitrol is superior to the pills, okay? And there's less side effects, liver side effects.
Yeah, but Vivitrol's $950.
$700, yeah. And that's why I didn't use a lot of it, because we had other ways to spend that money in terms of getting people sober living.
$16 for naltrexone.
I'm with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. And then the implant's a lot more expensive, but that may even be more effective.
Not at Kaiser. Kaiser believes in the implant.
Well, it's not FDA approved yet. So anyway, I don't want to get
They're giving it at Kaiser.
Good. Because there's...
What is that? A research thing?
Probably. Oh. It not enough is yet made of these blocking agents. They block the ability to get high from opiates.
And your ability to be treated for pain.
Well...
If you get in a car accident, right?
Maybe. But it decreases the response of euphoria from alcohol. It may decrease the thinking about alcohol, too. And it may, again, in my experience, have a little utility with stimulants.
Of all the drugs, in all the harm reduction, all the psych stuff that's supposed to reduce craving, naltrexone is the one drug I've seen work.
Yeah, and I don't understand why the excessive enthusiasm for Suboxone and the naltrexone Narcan stuff is sort of marginalized. And even people like, oh no, people die when they take that. I'm like, show me the research. And let's remind everybody, Suboxone,
they die if they take naltrexone.
That's what our psychiatric colleagues say. But listen, SAMHSA and NIDA are
love Suboxone
in business with the drug company and generating income for those organizations on Suboxone and obviated their generic application. They need generics, and they're continuing to benefit and did the research in it. So there's a weird collusion there. It concerns me. That's all I'm saying. It concerns me.
Okay. Yeah. So I know two people. This is from Canada. I know two people who want to get into rehab. They've called all those numbers on TV, but due to money issues, they can't get into anywhere. They need medical detox. Dying for help. Please message me for more details. But
this is Canada?
Canada is her name.
Canada.
So,
there's assessment. Two different – National Assessment Foundation will help you straighten it out.
What's the number?
But let's.
It's the NationalAssessmentFoundation.com.
Yeah, we can go to that. Or National Addiction Foundation. Just NAF, type that in, it'll show up. But let's explain to people what's going on, because there's a lot of fear about Obamacare, and there's a lot of fear about why people can't get help. There are three types of insurance. There's good insurance, there's basic insurance, and there's Medicaid. Those are the three.
Basically.
only the good insurance gets you fancy rehab.
And doesn't do it for very long.
Yeah, but
you
month
can get
at
outpatient,
the most.
You can get outpatient for a while.
And, you get a sorry, month at the most total, and, yeah. 60 days, including outpatient,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
For really, really good Aetna PPO, that only people in unions. You can't buy that insurance
and really
anywhere.
Sick people can get it.
You can't buy that anywhere. Yeah. Yeah. You get it from a union. You get it from your job. So the other two categories of insurance do have programs mm-hmm. that are covered by just basic PPO insurance, HMOs, right? And Medicaid. But you've got to be willing to go there. And honestly, America wants to go to Malibu.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And only one out of three people.
I do too.
Only one out of three people can go to Malibu. And I just wanted to do a public service announcement about that.
Okay.
Right? Because when they think of rehab, and we've been kind of guilty of it, they think of really intense, therapeutic, and amazing teams, and like what we had on television,
yeah.
or like what they see in Malibu,
yeah,
or
yeah.
this kind of stuff.
You don't necessarily
you
need
can
that,
get,
by the
you
way.
Don't need it.
Yeah.
You can get sober. I got sober in the L.A. County Jail and
yeah.
a friend's couch.
You,
people get sober at county programs here, in the Salvation
now,
Army.
Now,
they get sober
Salvation
at their
Army's,
local hospital detox.
Right. Local. So a local hospital is a possibility,
yes.
and they are required to treat you. Hospitals can't turn you away. No matter what happens with
Obamacare.
But if
you got basic insurance, all hospitals
yeah.
are in-network.
So you can get an inpatient detox, then you can go to 12-step and a sober living, or even just 12-step from home. 12-step is free. People will sit on you and stay with you. People who stay sober themselves by helping you. It's insane that we are not using more 12-step. It's insane. It's free and it works.
It's free. And so just remember, on the back of your insurance card, it has a phone number. It says mental health and chemical dependency. Phone number. It will tell you what your insurance, what treatment centers your insurance
pays. But if it's
pays.
Bad, go to emergency room. Just go to the hospital if you have bad detox issues.
Well, I could
go.
Give an even better hint where you'd get 72 hours worth of help, but I won't.
All right. Do we wrap it up here? You have to go get your
one more. One,
right.
more.
One more.
One more.
I've been on Wellbutrin. Sorry, you guys. I've been on Wellbutrin for over 16 years. For depression and anxiety. Right now I'm going through tragedy and I'm experiencing the worst depression
oh.
I've ever had.
Oh my.
Should I try a different medication?
I don't think you should be in charge. Go to your doctor
yeah, don't
and
ever,
say,
yeah.
That's the thing about America. We have advertisements on television. Go
yeah.
tell your doctor what drug you want.
Yeah, no, no.
That's the most ridiculous thing
Look,
about...
I know about all these things. I would never dictate my own care. You need an objective evaluator.
So go to your doctor and tell them how you're feeling.
I think there's a good probability they will add something. That's probably what
Boost bar.
She sounds pretty unhappy, and they might change the kind of Wellbutrin or
they'll probably
the
give
dose.
Her Klonopin though.
No, yeah,
not necessarily.
Drew, you think too much of your colleagues.
Well, they're depressed. I mean, it's depression, and you know,
no, it's
they had a bill of
but she's going through a life thing, maybe you know, grieving
yeah.
or
yeah.
something,
and so some temporarily, some something. It's really sad. But anyway. Listen, Facebook Live, thank you for joining us.
Fun.
Anything else? Yeah.
I'm not going to ask this question, but I had a couple of people with your thoughts on Suboxone, but that's an entire different show.
No, sometimes I go off the deep end about Suboxone. I don't like the advocacy of it by non-addicts. Doctors advocating it who don't deal with
it. How about
the excessive
How about
enthusiasm?
For 10 years if it's being used for pain management?
That's fine. A proper use.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the excessive enthusiasm that's bothering us. The fact that doctors who don't understand addiction are being instructed and paid well to take 200 patients on with this. We know what we're doing. I couldn't take 20.
But they're advocating the sober community to get behind it.
No, no, no.
And that's the thing where it's a bridge too far for me. The addiction community, the treatment community, yeah. NIDA, SAMHSA. Like it is not a one size fits all.
Yes.
One of the things I'm looking at in 2018 at Aloe or Temecula or both, we're going to have a Suboxone with counseling track.
Sure. Sure.
Within an abstinence base,
yeah.
you have different tracks
yeah.
for different people.
Sure.
Have different needs.
Certain people,
and you put them in.
It can save their lives.
Yes,
for sure. And certain people, abstinence based treatment is not for everybody. Period, end of story, for sure.
And assessors matter.
Yeah.
The specialists who have been doing this for 20 years,
yeah.
not the academics who've been working in a lab somewhere.
True.
The people that have been on the streets with the junkies for 20 years, I know who needs to be on Suboxone. I have two clients on Suboxone. I recommended it.
Yeah.
But not 19-year-old kids that just started taking dope and you could be sober and turn their lives around and go to college
yeah.
instead of be a fry cook on Suboxone.
All right. We will leave it at that. Thank you very
much. I use that because the HBO special, that's what NIDA. It's the best they could come up with for the Suboxone.
The outcomes?
Outcome. Yeah. What's worked in
the other thing, they don't test them. They don't, the other thing I object to is they test urine unobserved, and they don't test for anything else often.
What so about doctors can't be on it? Pilots can't be on it? Chemical dependencies counselors can't be on it?
Why is it so great if we can't take it?
It's, right. It's another show, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll see you next time.
Wish I could have been better friend in the end than I am. Could have stuck around, but I ran with a pen and a plan. Damn, this city's wild. You never know what a smile can get you. Thought about you tonight, you were right. The lights keep me alive. Maybe I'm just a crazy kid, a half-wit. I like the bars dirty, dim lit. I wanna feel like I'm flying, but it's real. So I'm trying to steal a page from senior year. Well, dancing on the rooftops, dancing on the rooftops tonight. Dancing on the rooftops, dancing on the rooftops tonight. The sun is going down, moon is coming out. Play that music loud, and everybody sing it out. Cause we're dancing on the rooftops, dancing on the rooftops tonight. Time for change, disengage, do it our way or no way. Set the roof ablaze, heating up, ain't afraid of the bed that we made. She's dancing dirty, dipping down all flirty. Hope this building is sturdy. There's no one's in a hurry, hurry, hurry. We're dancing on the rooftops, dancing on the rooftops tonight. Dancing on the rooftops, dancing on the rooftops tonight. Sun is going down, moon is coming out. So play that music loud. Dancing on the rooftops tonight. Rooftops, where it's at. Find a ladder, chase a cat. Rooftops, where it's at. Find a ladder, chase a cat. Rooftops, where it's at. Find a ladder, chase a cat. Rooftops, where it's at, where it's at. Better find a skyline. Start living a high life. I'm losing my mind tonight. We're dancing on the rooftops, dancing on the rooftops. Dancing on the rooftops, dancing on the rooftops.